The day's biggest stories, the people behind the headlines, the conversations you won't hear anywhere else. I'm Christy Strasser. You're listening to Odyssey's On Deadline. Dolly Parton, a legend, an icon, a gift to the world, and now she's gone. She was among the most beloved personalities in the world. As the Associated Press described her, she's the rare celebrity whose appeal transcended generations, geography, and politics. Buckingham Palace honored her, and so did the people in the hardscrabble mountain town where she grew up. Most of all, though, she was entirely herself. Plastic surgery, curves, massive blonde wigs, and skin-tight outfits, a self-deprecating wit, and one-liners that'll outlive her. Here's more from WWJ in Detroit.
Legendary local music writer Gary Graff. And Gary, what stood out to you about Dolly Parton?
Just the sheer talent, Tony. I mean, you know, as you heard in that quote, Dolly wanting people to know that there were brains in there, that there was a heart in there. So many people don't know she was a great songwriter in addition to being the singer. I mean, she wrote Jolene. She wrote I Will Always Love You. And as a businesswoman, very smart, you know, took control of her career and really did some special things as an artist, as a philanthropist, as a business person. So it's just, I mean, you know, legend doesn't even begin to tap what she was. And she did so many things right and really led with a great example for what an artist could be. And also in country music, very importantly, what a female artist could be in that genre.
And Gary, you mentioned she was well known for country music, but Dolly Parton was one of those rare artists that crossed all genres. I don't care if you were a fan of R&B, if you were a fan of pop, you knew who Dolly Parton was from her music.
Well, and that's where the songwriter part comes in, Tony. Her music could be interpreted by artists of any genre, and she very famously did her own rock album a couple of years ago. Less said about that, the better, frankly. But she went there, and I do remember speaking with her, this would have been 20 years ago maybe, about a bluegrass version of Stairway to Heaven that she recorded. So she was a musician, not just a country musician, country artist. You know, she was a total artist. And really everything she touched was potent and strong and remains vital decades later.
And Gary, she was also quite the showman, or showwoman as you would. Anything about her shows you remember the most?
The sequins. I mean, you know, Dolly Parton may single-handedly be the reason I need glasses. Just her flash, but within that flash, her taste. Because no matter what she looked like, what the gown was like, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader outfit once, or whatever she was wearing, the voice got you. And you hung on the voice and on the performance. And that's what stuck with you.
And not only did she do that for singing, she also made the crossover into acting and 9 to 5. Everybody remembers what that movie is about and remembers Dolly Parton's role in that movie.
Absolutely. And Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Rhinestone, Steel Magnolias, Joyful Noise. Now she has a nice legacy in, you know, that really crosses all factors of the entertainment industry. Dollywood, the amusement park. I mean, she made more than her mark. You know, she made many marks.
Gary, don't tell my wife this, but Steel Magnolias is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Boy, don't tell her. I'm surprised you uttered that in public, but it's okay. we can help with that.
Thank you, Gary.
Earlier this summer, I was at Dolly Parton's travel stop for her grand opening, and Dolly Parton was there to do the ribbon ceremony. But a couple of years ago, I got to interview her, but live and in person, and it was just as you might think a Dolly Parton interview would go. It was absolutely dreamy and insanely funny. The very first thing that she said to us after we arrived, she had to take a break, and she walked by, and we all stopped our conversation and just kind of like stared at her and awed at her. She was like, "Well, y'all, even celebrities got to pee. I'll be back." So cute.
There's something so authentic about Dolly Parton.
Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because even after all the years of her being in the entertainment business, of her having the success that she has had, the level that she's had, she's still this same person that grew up in Tennessee, you know, the same person that grew up poor. It didn't go to her head
We're chatting with Holly Hutton of the Robin Holly Show on 99.5 WYCD. Holly, when a celebrity dies, it has an emotional impact. That impact lands differently for different people, but Dolly Parton is unique. I think you would agree, and in a more universal, sort of next level sort of way. Why is that, do you think?
She's the one celebrity that has always just been good and pushed out goodness into the world. And I think that's the thing that everybody maybe aspires to have or to be, or is just to have all of that good. And I think that's why she is so beloved. You really can't say a bad word about her because she doesn't give you that opportunity to.
Holly, let's talk about how this impacts the biz for a minute. As an insider here with country music, how consequential has Dolly Parton been to country radio, say, over the last half century? And what do you think her legacy will be?
She's already been working on her legacy and has left a legacy just in her imagination library, which is her library that she has, you know, nationwide in most areas of the United States to help literacy with children. So it's not just about her music. You know, she has really left an impact with that library, and that is to give books to children between the ages of 1 and 5 until they reach their 5th birthday, so that they all have a library before they go to school, which I think is absolutely incredible.
Impact on country radio as a female solo artist?
Her impact is huge. She's influenced every single person from the time that she started until now. I think every female artist looks up to Dolly Parton in some way, emulates Dolly Parton, even if it's just being unapologetically themselves, as she has been unapologetically herself. I think that really resonates for women in country music.
Holly, and then there are the movies.
Oh my God. Who can't forget 9 to 5? Did you know that when I was in high school, we did an air band and we performed working 9 to 5? I have no, now that I look back at it and I realize just how actually kind of inappropriate it is to be tying up. Because, you know, in the movie, she ties up her boss. And yeah. I was like, now seeing it with different adult eyes, I go, that's kind of actually inappropriate. But Dolly was beyond her time then.
Holly, you and I are probably about the same age, but we won't go down that road now. Favorite Dolly Parton movie? I was going to make it easy on you and ask your favorite Dolly Parton song, but I thought I'd go the movie route.
Oh, that's even so. The favorite Dolly Parton song is, I love her entire children's album. I always say that I never got to sing lullabies to my child because Dolly Parton was always singing them for me. I always played Dolly Parton music for him as I would rock him to sleep. She's a far better singer than I am, so why wouldn't I have her? So she really, you know, is that soundtrack for our lives.
Okay, I'll take the movie question myself and say Steel Magnolias because I'm from the South.
Yes, that's such a good one.
Let's move on to Meta, which lost a blockbuster lawsuit that could change social media usage forever. Here's WCCO in Minneapolis.
I'm Gracie Stockton. Attorney General Keith Ellison is applauding that historic settlement reached with Meta today. The company behind Instagram and Facebook agreed to pay more than $16.6 billion to states over child safety concerns on the platforms. Meta will pay Minnesota somewhere between $214 and $307 million under the agreement. The settlement also requires Meta to put in place new safety features for kids ages 13 to 17, like time limits, nighttime blocks, reducing social media comparison features like beauty filters and like counts, and more user-friendly parental controls.
A default daily time limit of 2 hours for users under the age of 18, a ban on displaying numbers of likes or reactions to users under age 18, a ban on cosmetic procedure image filters, the option for some users under 18 to have a non-personalized feed. That is significant because that gets at algorithmic changes with these platforms. What we're looking at here is an agreement that effectively concedes that some of the design features on these apps got young users addicted, and the states had claimed that that contributed to harming the mental health of these young users, and now Meta will be forced to make these changes. This is not just Instagram and Facebook. We have also seen similar cases against TikTok, Snapchat, YouTube, and the acknowledgement that these lawsuits have been targeting the design of these apps. It's not about the content content that's on there. This has really been a different legal approach that we've seen states and also individuals to take on these companies, going after specifically those design features, and now this acknowledgement from the companies that those features might change.
Meta has just agreed to settle the lawsuit it's facing from dozens of states over claims that its social media platforms harmed children's mental health. It's settling for billions of dollars for the states, as well as agreeing to some changes. New Jersey was one of the states suing. Attorney General Jennifer Davenport giving some of the details of the settlements.
We took on Meta, and subject to court approval, they've agreed to our demands: stronger safety features, ongoing oversight, accountability, including a settlement of up to $17.1 billion, including $525 million for New Jersey.
Meta has agreed to commit to establishing daily limits and blocks on nighttime use for teenage users, as well as enhanced age assurance measures to prevent children from accessing the platform or from accessing age-restricted content. The settlement still needs approval in court. New York's ban on local police assisting ICE is now in effect, but the fight over it is far from over. Nassau and Rensselaer counties have refused to end their agreements with ICE, and 15 sheriffs are suing the state and trying to block the law. Governor Hochul isn't having it. She's saying any police department or sheriff that disobeys or maintains those agreements will face legal action.
Against the background of losing America's most popular celebrity and wondering how social media will change, we're also fighting a trade war with Canada. And Newell Normand in New Orleans is among those who believe it should stop.
So we are joined by Ryan Young, Competitive Enterprise Institute senior economist. We are in a tariff war with Canada, retaliatory tariffs. I'm not sure who the ultimate loser is going to be. I have a pretty good idea, but Ryan's going to let us know. Ryan, welcome to the show. A lot of people are having a real difficult time making sense of everything that's going on here. Canada does have a lot of protectionist legislation that they enforce through tariffs. Thoughts?
Canada's average tariff rate against U.S. goods leading up to all this was about 1.75%. And for comparison, the U.S., before the Trump administration raised tariffs, had an average tariff rate actually higher than that. NAFTA and then the USMCA agreement brought tariffs between U.S. and Canada against each other to near zero. And now we're seeing a tit-for-tat escalation game, which is having rates on some goods as high as 50%. So things were not perfect before, but they were okay. And now things are getting a lot worse.
Yeah, I found some articles on farm products where Canada had like tariffs approaching 300% on eggs, milk, poultry, products like that. And obviously to protect their farmers, we engage in some of the same practices on behalf of our farmers. And then we actually pay farmers to take acreage out of production, right?
Yeah. You're right that Canada's dairy program, especially, and agriculture in general, are just a protectionist mess that needs to be reformed. And you're also right that policy in the U.S. is pretty similar, also a protectionist subsidized mess that needs to be reformed. And what I think we're going to find out the hard way is that tariffs are not going to encourage anybody to make those reforms that need to be made. So if this dispute really is about agriculture tariffs and some other tariffs that shouldn't be there, right idea, but wrong way of going about getting the reforms made.
So obviously this doesn't inure to the benefit of anyone. And I guess, again, although for the longest time, the Trump administration said the consumer doesn't really suffer the consequence of these tariffs, I think almost without exception, almost every economist says that's not true. The consumer somebody ends up paying more at some point in time. It's just a question of how much they're willing to take on and how much they're going to pass on.
That's exactly right. That's also one reason why a lot of tariffs aren't on finished goods, they're on inputs to other goods. You raise tariffs on steel, for example, it can take months or a year or longer for those higher steel prices to work their way through to higher car prices, higher construction prices, higher appliance prices. but people still pay those tariffs. They are a tax, and people will pay them one way or another.
How did this start, and where's this going? I mean, it seems obvious to me, and I've said this several times on this show, Carney and Trump, they simply don't like one another. I mean, it's so blatantly obvious. I don't know how anybody can say otherwise.
It's personal. You're right. That's what it is. It's clearly not about the merits. It's clearly not about helping consumers or about industry. Trump started it because he had a personal beef with Justin Trudeau, Canada's now former prime minister. And he also tends to have a negative view of Canada in general, as you can tell by his remarks about Canada being a 51st state. And Canada's current prime minister is returning the sentiment in kind. And while I certainly understand where he's coming from, that's retaliation is not going to do any good. All it's going to do is hurt Canada's economy as well as the U.S. economy. The best way to respond to someone raising tariffs against your products is restraint. Don't respond in kind. Don't take the bait. Don't feed the trolls.
The only one that could possibly step in is Congress and or the courts, because I know a lot of these tariffs that have been placed have been found to be not appropriate. I think most economists are in agreement saying that this particular happenstance with Canada may be one of the dumbest trade wars ever in the history of this country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is one of, if not the dumbest trade war we could possibly pick. Canada is one of our largest trading partners. Not only are we friends and neighbors, but we're part of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing organization, which means that if you're going to enact a national security tariff against a fellow Five Eyes member, if you don't trust Canada, who can you trust? They are an ally. They are not a national security threat. So on those grounds, it is the dumbest trade war you could possibly pick. And you're also right that only Congress can fix this. The president is going to continue raising tariffs and picking tariff fights unless the courts or Congress stop him. A court case is going to take as long as the administration lasts to resolve, but Congress could pass a bill today if it wants to.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.